Good morning, everybody. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, and ably assisted by our extraordinary engineer, Mr. Terry Wilson. We're fortunate to have as a guest today Mr. Drew Herzig, who's a local dance instructor and as well as a member of the Astoria City Council. Drew, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for inviting me.
I always like to start out with a little kind of biographical sketch of 3 to 5 minutes to describe your entire life.
I don't think it'll take that long, but I was born in California. That's been brought up against me repeatedly, but I'm not ashamed of it. I was born in Pasadena, Southern California. Spent most of my life in Northern California in the Sacramento area, Central Sacramento Valley kind of thing. In the early 2000s, I moved down to New Mexico and lived with my partner, Charles Schweigert. He's an artist there. He was living in Santa Fe. And then after a while there, we decided we wanted to try the West Coast again to check out the art market on the West Coast and moved to Portland, Oregon. And that was in, I think, 2005. Spent about 4 years there. It was a really interesting experience. Santa Fe has a big reputation, but it's really a small city, small town kind of thing.
Yeah, my mother's family came from there.
Yes,
spent a lot of time there.
Yes, it's a beautiful place. It's got a lot going for it kind of thing. I didn't cope well with the altitude, unfortunately, the attitude either. Yeah. My system just didn't adjust to the altitude, so I was dizzy and short of breath a lot, so that was another motivation. So we checked out Portland, and Portland was a good second-tier city. Neither of us wanted to live in Los Angeles or couldn't afford San Francisco or Seattle, that sort of thing, so Portland was a good choice. And we did well there for about 4 years, but then it became feeling like it was just too big a town. It was, streets were always torn up. We lived in the Woodstock area near Reed College. Anytime we wanted to go downtown, it was an ordeal. You know, it's traffic, parking, all that sort of stuff. So we looked around, and looked all over Portland, looked all over Oregon, looked at Northern California, Central California kind of thing, and son of a gun, ended up in Astoria in 2009. And it's been quite a ride ever since.
Are you satisfied with your move to Astoria?
Yes. It's nice because it's a small enough town where you feel you can make a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's important to me. You know, it has all the charms and all the drawbacks of a small town kind of thing. There isn't as much cultural life as we would like. As much as KMUN supports, promotes, and creates the cultural life here, we're still a little bit behind Portland, you know, but we're doing what we can about that.
Then you decided, for some obscure reason, to run for Astoria City Council. How did that come about?
People told me I should have my head examined. they were quite upfront about that. But Astoria being a small enough place where you feel you can make a difference, I was trying to find ways to be part of the community, to have an impact here. So I started attending city council meetings. And it was fascinating because it's right there. Councillor Lemire at one meeting, this was before I ran, brought up the fact that the trees that were planted in pots in the former Safeway parking lot hadn't been watered and they were dead. And I thought, well, that's just housekeeping. You know, we can handle that. Mm-hmm. That's something we could do. And I thought, this is manageable. These problems aren't overwhelming. Let's just kind of focus on them sort of thing. So I thought, well, and then when it turned out that I was living in a ward where there was a seat in contention, I thought, what the heck?
It was kind of surprising that you meet longtime Astorian, an NBA, as they're called, native-born Astorian. They're kind of cliquish, those folks, you know. And it was kind of surprising to a lot of people that you actually won that race, but I understand that you worked pretty darn hard to do it.
Well, I did what I could. I wish I could have done more, but I did go door-to-door in the ward, and that was very educational. You know, I had to force myself. I'm not an extrovert, so it was hard for me to go up and knock on somebody's door. But just going door-to-door in Ward 2 and seeing the state of some of the houses, the poverty, the falling down kind of thing, seeing people in walkers and on oxygen tottering up to the door to answer it kind of thing, just it brought me very close to the people in Ward 2, and I really felt I was glad I was able to do that. Whether or not it I got elected to be able to meet the people and see how people are living here in Australia. And also, I have to say, also a lot of empty second homes. A lot of the people who were already off for the winter somewhere south, and that was another educational part of it. There are a lot of large homes that sit empty half the year here in Australia. And so that was, it was educational.
I know that you, I don't know much about it, but you do dance instruction. Tell me a little bit about that portion of your life.
Well, a child of the 70s, we're all old enough to remember the 70s and counterculture, and particularly back in California, international folk dancing was huge. You know, it was almost every college and university had a folk dance class and clubs and that sort of thing, and it was something that people were suddenly exploring world culture, basically, and exploring it through world music and world dance. And I know that this station does a lot of Celtic music here, and that's been big as well. But along with Celtic music, there was Balkan music, music from Greece, Bulgaria, former Yugoslavia, that sort of thing, which was, and we're also old enough to remember the mysterious voices of Bulgaria when that sort of kind of broke. So there were dances to go along with that, and I happened to be attending a college that had a folk dance class and a folk dance club, and I tried it and I loved it. I wasn't that good at it, but it was something that was cooperative rather than competitive. It was community movement, and it was moving to this beautiful music, and it was just fantastic. So I got into it, and when I realized the strong roots it has in community, how community dancing builds community, supports community, and teaches community, I was hooked.
So that kind of music came from Eastern Europe, I understand?
Yes.
And how does that relate to klezmer music?
Klezmer is a form of Eastern European music. It's the Jewish music of Eastern Europe. It's sort of like Jewish blues, basically. And it's really intriguing because we're talking about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, when there were very few borders, when people, musicians, cultures moved back and forth and shared that. So if you listen to klezmer music, you can hear blues, you can hear Balkan, you can hear Roma, Gypsy influences. It's a fascinating blend. It really is.
Now, the Roma music, I'm thinking of Django Reinhardt, a guitar player from the late 20s, early 30s, who was an innovator in jazz harmonies. Does that tie in with the kind of music that you're talking about?
Not so much, because the dance music that the people who danced to it use had to be fairly rhythmic. If you were going to dance to it, it had to have a steady beat. And so it wasn't quite as jazzy and innovative as some of the Django Reinhardt material kind of thing. It was more traditional. There have been non-traditional instrumentations. They've been the electronic keyboard and all that sort of thing. So they're getting different instrumentation, but for it to be good dance music, you have to have, just as Dick Clark would say, you have to have that solid beat that you can dance to.
Well, describe for me the instrumentation of a band that would be playing the kind of music that you're describing.
Oh, it depends on who can afford the instruments. The traditional instruments were like the bagpipe. Believe it or not, the bagpipe was one of the traditional instruments of the Balkans kind of thing. It was a traditional instrument of the whole Mediterranean basin, basically. Bagpipes were used in Italy, in Spain, in Northern Africa. It's called the midgewiz over in Palestine, that sort of thing. So the bagpipe was one of your basic things. And to have a dance, you just needed a bagpipe and a drum, and you were all set. There were other stringed instruments called the tambura, which is sort of like, well, the bouzouki is the one that most people would relate to, the Greek thing, similar to the balalaika in Russia, that kind of a stringed instrument. Some sort of flute, it's called the kaval in Bulgaria. It's an end-blown flute, so it's that kind of thing. It's quite tricky to play. And then they would have various pipes, that sort of thing. So now, well, transitional, the accordion came in, and since the accordion was a one-man band, you didn't need anything, you just needed the accordion, so that sort of made it easier for one person to be a folk band. Now they will have large ensembles, they will have electric keyboards, they will have all sorts of other things, but basically you need a good loud instrument and percussion, and you're set.
Well, I've kind of gotten sidetracked here from my agenda. I wanted to talk
culture
about
corner. Yeah. Yeah,
I wanted to talk about some City of Astoria stuff, since you're a pretty active member of the city council. Now, the council has four members and the mayor.
Correct.
And you represent Ward 2, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And there have been a lot of issues lately. One that's getting a lot of talk around town is the kind of attempt by the city to sell off a lot of city-owned property. And that resulted in a lot of discussion, and I'm certain that you can tell us quite a bit. Number one, I'd like to know how that came about. How did the city and why did the city decide to start selling stuff? And then what kind of feedback did you get from the citizens?
Well, it started at last year's goal-setting session that the council attends, and it actually came from the city manager, Paul Benoit, who brought it to the council and saying, we've got a lot of little scraps of property that we're not doing anything with, and it would probably be better if we could offer them to people who live nearby, to the adjacent property owners kind of thing, to see if they would like to take them on. And to my, the way I saw it was little scraps of land. He said, little postage stamps here, there's that sort of thing. So it seemed not that big a deal. So the council adopted it as a goal for last year kind of thing. Then it sort of went along, and we were told, well, a list has been drawn up of properties that we're going to be selling kind of thing, and area property is going to be handling the marketing. And it seemed to be, okay, we weren't looking into it as closely as we should. And I don't think we told the public as much as we should about what was being planned. Mm. The first round of letters that went out created quite a lot of upset because people got these letters. They were told there's an adjacent property that's going to be put on the public market in 5 to 7 days unless you can come up with a bid. And people freaked. We were getting calls. I got calls. Willis got calls.
Yeah, I got one of those letters.
Yes, exactly. Actually, the mayor got one of those letters. So we had to say, wait a minute, this wasn't quite what we intended, and so we had to put the brakes on it and say, "What? Now we need to know what the process is." We assumed that the process was in place, and we found out the process wasn't really going to work, so we had to stop and say, what is the process? And I guess you could say that we've been asking, what is this process from that time? And finally, people kept coming up and giving us their opinions on how the process is or is not working. And my feeling is the more we looked into it, the less we understood what we had set in motion. That's why I felt it behooved us to stop it and examine it and see, do we know what we're doing? Do we know that this is treating people fairly? Do we know where we're going with this? And fortunately enough, citizens were heard agreeing that it was maybe time to stop and reexamine it. Nobody has opposed selling very small parts of non-buildable land to adjacent property owners who just wish to round it off or to make sure that nobody ever acquires it and builds on it. I'm not saying that we should never sell any city property, but the process seemed incomprehensible to almost everybody, and that's why I said, and I wasn't alone in saying, that we need to stop it and really get more feedback on how this can work for people.
Yeah. Well, it's time for me to remind the listeners, Terry, that we are Coast Community Radio, KMUN and KTCB in Tillamook, and it's Friday show with Jim Wilkins, and I happen to be Jim Wilkins. I'm happy to be here visiting with Drew Herzig, a member of the Astoria City Council. Now, a lot of other issues coming up for the city, one of which I'm particularly interested in is the improvements of the river trail and the river visioning and the property basically from the Maritime Museum East. What can you tell us about the progress of that project?
Well, I've been going to the Planning Commission, and they've been putting in a heck of a lot of work on this. Their task now is to write code to implement the vision that was put in place a number of years ago. That was before my time here, but I'm sure were part of that, there were many, many meetings where public input was solicited. Exactly. And apparently from those meetings, a riverfront vision plan was put in place. And I believe you can find that on the city website. The Planning Commission now is charged with the task of writing code that will enforce or basically set up guidelines for implementing that vision. They cannot change the vision. They were told that they could not decide to prohibit any building in the riverfront. They have to write code that will limit that building, but they cannot prohibit it. So they're going meeting after meeting, examining the heights of buildings, scope of buildings, color of buildings, layout. Do they want it to be riverfront level, or can it rise one or two stories? All sorts of things. Anything that's going to be happening along the riverfront, they have to write code for. And so it's a lot of work for them. They're having meetings. Now, this coming week, there's a Tuesday and a Thursday meeting. One is on the riverfront, and the other is on the transportation system. And I'm sorry, I don't know which is which, but they're both big issues in Astoria. So I would really, if people haven't attended a Planning Commission meeting, it's really worth attending to see how much work the volunteers on that commission do.
Yeah, I spent 7 years on the Planning Commission myself.
So you can testify.
A thankless task.
Yes.
You know, that's where you run into the real conflict of property rights versus community rights. And it's a kind of a constant battle, writing code, taking into account that dichotomy. Could you speak a little bit about that particular issue?
It really is difficult because any individual or a community may have a vision for the riverfront or various places, but then you have to realize that it involves private property. It's not all public land, and you have to write code that enables people to develop their land in a way that can work for them, you know, at the same time that the community vision has to work together. So it's a lot of fiddly work. It's very detailed. I mean, they were talking about, can a building be 50 feet wide, 20 feet wide, 30 feet wide, in order to make it, you don't want to have it a scenic wasteland. At the same time, you don't want to have the riverfront all condos and all high-rises kind of thing. So it's a real challenge to find the right balance that will take advantage of this incredible gift that Astoria has, this incredible river vista, but at the same time not say we're just going to basically level every building and it's going to be just one big walkway kind of thing. I have to say that Rosemary Johnson, our city planner, I don't know how she does it, remembering all the codes, all the ordinances, all the restrictions. It's
She's
just
remarkable.
It's an incredible job, yes.
Yeah. Now, you've been on the council for a while. Characterize for me, if you would, your take on the mayor, Willis Van Dusen.
Willis really wants to make people happy. He really cares about people. It's been interesting working with him for a year. He will remember conversations he had with historians from 20, 30 years ago, and they still are important to him. A while ago, he intervened in a little a property dispute, and he told us that he did that because about 20 years ago, he had to say no to a request from one of those people, and that had bothered him, so he felt he was trying to make up for it by helping out to resolve a little dispute kind of thing, things like that, that the people of Astoria really matter to the mayor.
Well, Drew, we've got a couple of questions here that came in through the door.
Uh-oh.
Question number one. Can a riverfront building be eliminated from any part of the waterfront?
Not currently, to my understanding. And again, I'm not on the Planning Commission, and I'm not the city planner kind of thing, but I believe there is no code that says the city can come and demolish a building. They can put restrictions on any rebuilding or any serious renovation kind of thing, and they're looking at that. But as to the best of my knowledge, and again, I'm not the authority, but to the best of my knowledge, the city has no, if it's not a derelict building, if it's being owned and maintained, the city has no right to come in and say, we're going to take down your building.
Now, wasn't there talk of changing an ordinance or putting in an ordinance specifically to deal with the abandoned Flavel buildings?
Now that's not on the riverfront visioning. That's a
right.
City ordinance about derelict buildings, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a long, long pursuit that has come up recently, that the city, through the use of the derelict building ordinance, has put a number of liens on the Flavel properties, and they are going to use those liens as leverage to finally, hopefully, be able to say that they're going to go under the gavel to be sold to pay off the liens kind of thing. That's still evolving, and I know some people, it's been a long, long, long process, but they're trying to cross their T's and dot their I's to make sure that they can do this in a way that can't be undone at the last minute, as happened so often in the past.
Yeah. Well, this next question seems to be directed specifically to you. How would you answer criticism that some of your clarification questions and comments actually just slow down the meetings?
I think we are there to do business in as transparent a way as possible, and they may slow down the meetings, but if it gives people the information they need to give us feedback and help us make information, that's what we're there for. We're not there to rush through a meeting. We are there to get all the information we need to make the best decisions for the people of Astoria. The City Council, we are the ones elected to represent the people. We are not there to represent the staff. We represent the people. I really feel that if I have a question, I figure somebody else in the public might have that same question. And I feel it's incumbent on all of us to ask the questions for the benefit of the people of Astoria. We're there representing the people. And we need to make sure that we're operating in the best interest of the people. And if it slows down the meeting, I do apologize for that. But I think time spent on democracy is time well spent.
You know, I agree with you, Drew.
Thank you.
What are some of the other issues that you're really concerned about dealing with here in the next few months?
Well, I'm not sure if we can do it in the next few months, but I'm really concerned about the level of poverty in Astoria and Clatsop County. I was looking, the New York Times has an interactive map from the 2012 census, and we've got an overall rate in Astoria of about 20%, which means one in five people are living at or below the federal poverty level. And that's not just a story. I mean, nationally, there are huge forces at work here kind of thing. But it really is important to me that we take care of Astorians who are living at the edge. I really want, and I've been talking to some of the local churches and community organizations, we need to put more in place to help people stay in their houses, to stay warm and fed and that sort of thing. Terry Wilson here has been very vocal about creating warming shelters, and I want to help also with emergency shelters. The temperatures are not our only difficulties here. There are other things that we need to provide, places where people can go in case of emergency, whether it's freezing temperatures, it might be severe rain, power outages, that sort of thing. That's a big concern to me. We need to take care of the people of Astoria, and realizing that one in five, and that includes children, one in five people living in Astoria is living at or below the poverty level. That's something we need to really keep front and center.
Now, do you think that's the job of the City Council to address that issue?
Not directly, but the city needs to be a partner. This has got to be a public-private partnership. The local churches, Clatsop Community Action, other organizations, the county, we all need to work together on that. It's not any one organization's responsibility to take it all on, but collectively, as a community, and that includes the City Council, we are part of the community, we all need to be part of the solution to this, I believe.
I noticed in the newspaper's account of your goal setting this year that once again the Astoria bypass made it as a it's been 20 or 30 years that's been a goal. So Drew, I'm on this year, are we going to get a bypass?
The short answer is no. But it'll continue to be a goal as long as anybody is left standing on the City Council, because people, they are reluctant to take that off the goals because people want it to happen, and the City Council feels that they need to be a voice for that. Even if they have no real power to bring it into being, they still want to keep it as a goal because they don't want to let people down.
Yeah. Well, we've got another question called in by a listener. The new top goal is the library remodel. Is there enough money for the remodel? And will there be any more public input if the design has to be scaled back?
I certainly hope there will be public input. I think one of the lessons we've learned is that we always need to come to the public when we do a public project, and we need to keep them involved from start to finish. The library board is going to create a foundation to start fundraising. So there is some money available, but there's going to be a lot of fundraising involved. That's going to be another big community project. But we really need to renovate and expand the library. That's something that will benefit the whole community. So the money is not there right now, but the money can be acquired through a community
effort.
Well,
there's a big chunk of money that is left to the city for a library.
Yes.
Over $1 million,
yes, yes, yeah. But a library renovation is going to cost considerably more than that. But it's doable. I mean, it's an important investment in the future, and the money is there. We just need to go out and get it.
And another part of that, of course, then, is the infamous Waldorf Hotel.
Yes.
There's talk about tearing it down. There's talk about leaving it there. What's your take on that particular part of the problem?
Well, I'd like to try to be clear about this. The Waldorf Hotel means a lot to some people in town. The building is so derelict that I don't think we would ever find an investor or an entrepreneur who would want to come and rehab it to make it a hotel
again. Have you been
into it? No, I've heard that.
I haven't either.
Basically, Rosemary Johnson is talking about giving people tours of it so they can see how bad it is in there. But again, as people read in the paper, that bits of it have been falling off and flooding, that sort of thing. I would like to see us look at possibly preserving the facade on the north side, the Duane Street side. If we could preserve that facade and make that the front of the library, the community section of the library, which is going to be the first part of the project, I think that could be a really good thing. That would be combining our history and our future. I don't know how expensive that would be. I'd love to see the Lower Columbia Preservation Society get involved in that, but I know the building cannot be saved, but I would like to see us look at the facade to see if that could be preserved and used as part of the new library.
And it'd have to be saved in such a way that it would meet current seismic codes.
Yes, the facade itself, I'm sure it could be reinforced. The building itself, it cannot be saved. I'm pretty sure it cannot be saved. But the facade, I'd really like the city and the people who work on historic buildings here in town to look at that and see if that can be saved.
Well, we've got 2 minutes left, Terry tells me. Which means you've got 2 minutes left to say what you want.
Well, I really appreciate your inviting me to be here, Jim, and I'd be happy to come back anytime. I'm glad people are calling in with questions. I've tried to have monthly meetings, and I'll be having one again in March when anybody can come and meet with me and ask these questions. I really wanted to hear from people, and I'm not afraid of the questions. I would like people to let me know what they think I'm doing right and what they think I'm doing wrong and how I can do better. So I appreciate the chance to be part of this. Thank you.
And in the bit of time that we've got left, what are the other city? You guys just did goal setting.
Yes.
What other goals have you set for yourself for the coming year?
Continuing with the riverfront, again, the goal I brought was about emergency shelters and warming shelters to partner with the community in setting up and maintaining them. I'm trying to remember some of the goals here offhand. I can't give them to you. I'm sorry about that. But they'll be in the paper, and they will be coming up again before the public as well. The public will still have more input on the council goals, so stay tuned.
Stay tuned, huh?
Yes.
Well, we've got just a little bit of time left. Terry says less than a minute. He goes like this. That means we've got half a minute.
All right.
So my job during that half a minute is to kind of eliminate any dead air. And so I do that by talking like this without really saying anything, but I've got to fill the time here for another 20 seconds. Terry, I'm certainly glad that you're here with your fingers giving me those oddball signs. It's been Friday here at Coast Community Radio. I've been Jim Wilkins, and I see another note came in. Just bear with me a minute. The city's goals are on the city's website.
Right.
So if somebody needs to define those goals, that's where you can find them.
I'll be heading home and checking that out right now.
But we'll be here again next Friday. I kind of forget who we've got coming in, but we're going to have a wonderful show next Friday. Please stay tuned for Albert Smith and his always wonderful folk show. Thanks again.